John Grayson, Rob Ross, once again hanging out with you, talking over the latest in popular culture. And boy, has it been a week. Unbelievable. And Rob, how's everything going in New York?
Well, things in New York are okay. I mean, there have been sporadic protests by the obligatory social justice warriors and virtue signalers. But by and large, things have been okay and quiet here. I unfortunately have managed to pick up one of those dreadful summer colds. I'm trying in my best power to stave it off as much as possible. So I'm doped up to the eyeballs right now on cold remedies.
Attaboy.
Keep it at bay.
Yeah.
Instead of turning into a full-fledged head cold, because God knows those are so difficult to shake off, and I just don't have the time nor the patience to deal with it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, the social justice warriors you were talking about here in the middle of the country, there has been a fascination with what happened in Virginia, but it has not gotten here. I mean, there's been, to the best of my knowledge, no protesting around. There had been a little bit on the anniversary of the Michael Brown shooting a little while ago in Ferguson, but that was about it. And so it's more been just this, oh, I think they're going crazy out on the coasts again kind of mentality.
I would agree with that. You know, it's always the big cities kind of scenario and syndrome. But, you know, I'll take umbrage with the whole notion of it, because with all the never-ending litany of Black Lives Matter, well, there was apparently a horrific landslide, a mudslide in Sierra Leone.
Yep.
Not a single word was mentioned, written, nothing. Those are Black Lives. Those Black Lives mattered.
Right.
If people in general, and I'm talking about people who are just normal, in quotation marks, would look at the big picture scenario, you realize all that's getting out there in the media right now is being supplanted by empty vessels. This is how these people across the boards make themselves feel good about themselves, let alone think that they're contributing to society. No, what you're doing is helping to aid and abet the assholes out there who are doing their best to fuck it all up.
Right. I mean, the deal with the Nazis and the Klansmen and everything else, all this is doing is publicizing them more and getting them more attention. Yes, they need to be fought when they show up in town, but no, we don't need to constantly bang the drum and get the recruiting numbers up for them either.
Well, the thing is, you know, you and I talked about this almost from the very beginning of this show, and I've really taken it to heart, and right now I'm on a moratorium of the word Nazi, because for the billionth time, as you rightfully pointed out from the very beginning, there were only one group of Nazis, and they were in Germany.
Yeah.
These are not Nazis. These are a bunch of inbred assholes. they want to ape the politics and I don't even know what you want to call it, you know, the horseshit that Hitler and the actual Gestapo spewed. But these aren't Nazis. They're
right.
Not Germans. Their grandfathers fought against the Nazis. And so once again, like everything else, especially in the here and now, you know, verbal, written, you know, linguistic misappropriation seems to rule the day.
No doubt about it. And the one thing that they do share in common is that this new group is nothing but a bunch of kids who feel like they deserve. I mean, they're a bunch of entitled little assholes. They think they deserve everything handed to them on a silver platter. And when they end up like that one dickbag who got arrested in Virginia over this, losing their job at the hot dog stand. I mean, what does that tell you? He's a fucking loser at a job at a hot dog stand. You know, this was not a kid who was setting the world on fire. So they look to each other for some kind of identity, so that they can lean on each other, because they have absolutely nothing else. They sure as hell don't have girlfriends.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's how it always falls out on the right.
Yep.
And on the left, like I said, the empty vessels, the angry, embittered, you know, they probably either can't get laid, they're atheists, whatever the hell it is. You know, these are the same assholes that go out and pull this counter-protest bullshit in the hopes, and I'm using the word hopes very loosely, that a skirmish will occur so that way they can be justified in their counter-protests.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, blood and soil, more like semen on the rug. But anyway, we've got a lot more to talk about. Let's get on to the important stuff because we lost some absolutely legendary names just over the last couple of days. And you and I, last time we talked, were just maybe a day removed from finding out that founding member of the Wrecking Crew, even though I don't think that's what he intended to do at the time, and legendary guitar player, singer, songwriter Glen Campbell was gone. Give me your thoughts, first of all, just about Glen Campbell, the life and career of.
From the time I was a child, I loved his voice. I loved his songs. I think Wichita Lineman is one of the greatest things ever recorded.
Yep.
Jim Webb is, was, and will always be a masterful songwriter. And pairing him up with Glen Campbell worked, especially on that song. But to be honest with you, I found it most offensive when I heard REM's rendition of it. I don't care whether or not they intended it to be tongue in cheek or if they were actually doing it because they loved the song. No. No, 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 no. You stay away. You stay away from that song. Glen Campbell was just an amazing guitar player, and that's putting it very mildly. I mean, he could play like there was no tomorrow. You talk about your Jimi Hendrixes. Listen to the fluidity of the way the man played guitar. He had such a silky voice. He could sing the kickin' more popular songs like, later on, of course. Rhinestone Cowboy or Southern Nights, but when he would sing a ballad, you felt it. You felt the emotion of Wichita Lineman or Galveston. Or By the Time I Get to Phoenix. He was a consummate showman, and of course, it bothers me in a lot more of a personal manner the way he passed away because he suffered from Alzheimer's, which helped take my father at an earlier age. So, it's I feel the pangs of that acutely.
Yeah, no doubt. And with the legacy that he leaves behind, I mean, as we said, not only was it songs like Wichita Lineman, not only was it when he had his star and his name on the door, but everything that he did before that. And the real tragedy, even with things like the Wrecking Crew movie that is now out, the documentary that takes you through a lot of that and shows, there's a lot of it that's also shown in the documentary that was done about the making of Pet Sounds, but there's no real accounting of who played on what. There's a lot of speculation about who went where, but the one thing that you can count on is that that Glen Campbell and that guitar were on more rock and roll and rockabilly hits between probably 1961 and 1966 than you could possibly put together and imagine.
Absolutely. And don't forget, I mean, let's throw in the fact that he played on a couple of records by the Monkees on those first sessions.
Right.
The fact is, he was a member of the Beach Boys. He was asked to stay permanently, but couldn't because his Capitol career was about to start.
Yep.
And christened with his first single, Guess I'm Dumb, which was written for him by Brian Wilson. But he was, in fact, the touring replacement for Brian Wilson until they found Bruce Johnston. So, Glen Campbell was, in fact, part of everything that was important, certainly in American music, American recorded music, in that heyday of the mid-60s.
Right, and a guy who could capably, incredibly switch from lead guitar or rhythm guitar to bass and could do it all and do it all and make your jaw drop.
Well, listen to his 12-string guitar playing.
Yeah,
I
no
think that's
doubt.
all that needs to be said as far as his musicianship goes.
That's where it really shines. Absolutely. So a sad goodbye to Glen Campbell. And we found out yesterday that Dick Gregory was gone. And that one, just for the last month or two, they've been running this History of Comedy thing on CNN. And I saw the episode come up on Comedy and Race. And I thought, if Dick Gregory isn't a huge part of that, it's a crime. And he was. So well done, CNN, there. I'll give you a pat on the back, at least on that front. But the fact that a guy who was so much more than a comedian and who he was the first person that I, after learning who he was and going back and listening to some of his earlier stuff and watching some of the stage work that he did, when it would come up and when it was finally available to us, learning a little bit more about what he did as a social and civil rights activist, he was the first guy that I ever went, wow, he doesn't sugarcoat anything. There is no bullshit about this man at all. And he was able to, in those club gigs, turn that no bullshit into incredibly funny. And I mean, he was such a talent, and what a crime it is that this is the last time that he saw.
unfortunately is correct. I mean, he was, you know, it's interesting to me because everybody always lauds Richard Pryor as the groundbreaker, but I always thought Dick Gregory really deserved an equal share of that because, if I'm not mistaken, he was out there first.
Yeah.
Now, there's always that argument of the, you know, well, does it really matter? Yeah, it does matter because if the person who really was pioneering this thing or a driving force when there was none, then that person deserves the credit. And, you know, he was doing his stand-up in 63, 64. I think just as Pryor was getting his first licks in as well. But I think Dick Gregory already had been on a roll, so to speak. But, you know, he wasn't just a comic and he wasn't just a social rights activist in the true sense of civil rights. He was also an author, and he wrote an incredibly successful and controversial book. But the reason why he wrote it and titled it what he did was simply to emphasize the point that and it was a point that was made by his friend Lenny Bruce, that when you take a word and you say it enough times, it does in fact become meaningless.
Right, right.
You know, like Lenny Bruce used to say, you know, saying the word fuck isn't dirty, you know. Hiroshima was dirty, mm-hmm. You know, and that's a very salient point. So, you know, Dick Gregory wrote a book called Nigger, and it was controversial, certainly for its time and place. But read it and read what he was talking about, and you will understand why he titled it such.
Yeah,
that's the whole thing. People just want to focus on the title and not the meat that's in between the slices of bread.
You know, you just reminded me of something. And There's a lot in the news right now about Jimmy Fallon. Not that I'm making any connections between Dick Gregory and Jimmy Fallon, but I'm going to try and wind this back around. There's a lot in the news right now about Jimmy Fallon. He's made a couple of pointed comments in the last week or so about Donald Trump, and we'll get back to that part of the news in just a minute. But for the longest time, the knock on him was he's so saccharine and he's so nice to everybody and he never does anything edgy. And I thought, you know, if you want a real perspective into why people get pissed about that, because if all you've done is grown up in an era where there were, you know, Jimmy Fallons, and I mean, Kimmel's a little bit more edgy, but still, there is nothing like there was when Dick Gregory was sitting across the desk from Jack Parr on Jack Parr's show. And go back and watch those. Find those on YouTube. Find those in an archive somewhere. You know? And that was 50 years ago.
You know, that's the jumping off point, but watch Dick Gregory on Dick Cavett.
Yeah.
Because when you've got those two minds in the same place at the same time.
Right.
Then you've got a conversation. Then you've got a dialogue of substance, consequence, and meaning.
Right. And there was, granted, there was a lot going on then, but you know what? Read the papers, man. There's a lot going on now. And the third name, again, another legendary comic
This is huge.
Yeah.
Today, and this one is, you know, a legend that every single one of us grew up with, and I don't know how many generations worth, but Jerry Lewis passed away today at the age of 91. And that, another one, very personal, because he was my mother's favorite entertainer. And, you know, if anybody made me laugh as a kid, it was certainly him. Not just the whole, nice lady!
Well done.
That's one thing. Thank you. But to me, I mean, the first time that I ever just in hysteria watching him and listening to him was, what'll it be? No. Come here. I want you to pay attention. Buddy
right.
Love was a stroke of absolute genius to take the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde story and turn it into the Nutty Professor.
Yep.
It was just brilliant. If he never did another movie after that, he wouldn't have had to, because his comedic genius was sealed right there. Never mind the years with Dean Martin. You know, never mind all the movies that he did afterwards. Never mind King of Comedy. If I have to hear people lauding that one again, it's a case of you really don't know Jerry Lewis's career that well. That's your only point of reference. And of course, what kid didn't sit and watch a good portion of the Muscular Dystrophy Telethon, which was started and hosted by Jerry Lewis till 2011, every Labor Day weekend? I mean, we all grew up with it. You know, I was deliberately sat in front of the TV by my parents so we could watch this, especially around the 6 o'clock hour when you knew Jerry was, you know, doped up to the eyeballs on Percocet and falling off the stool, and he's going to belt out, "You'll never walk alone," like he always did. But man, you know, there are moments when I just thought over the last 20 years, maybe even more, that, you know, the telethon lost it. But I think nothing was the same after Schmoll died. And if you don't know who that is, go do your homework, because I'm not going to explain it to you. You should know these things. But Jerry Lewis, man, Jerry Lewis was a giant. And I find it interesting that for a country like France that's so virulently anti-Semitic, the flags are going to fly at half staff tomorrow for
yeah,
him.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because they absolutely love him.
Oh, well, well.
Well, and to go back to that, I mean, with the telethon, you're right. I mean, we learned as little kids a lot about the last 20 years of pop culture leading up to where we were at the time from watching the Jerry Lewis telethon. I mean, whatever we didn't get from Love Boat, we got from Jerry Lewis, and we saw these great entertainers.
Right. I mean, you know, when we were kids and we were watching the telethon, you know, first of all, it was co-hosted by Ed McMahon, but
yep.
You would see, of course, Sinatra. Sammy was there. Sammy was always part. Sammy had to be part of it, you know. Of course, Sinatra brought Dean Martin out to reunite them after how many years? In 1976, I think it was, what, 20 years, 25 years at that point?
Had to be close, yeah.
152, whenever it was, they split up. I mean, you know, you would see people from Lena Horne to Harry Belafonte to Jesus, Jan Murray, and now I'm going into the Borscht Belt, notice. And, you know, you had rock bands, and you had, you know, Bette Midler, or you had, Jesus, you had everybody.
Yeah.
And I knew everybody who was anybody. Tony Orlando hosted the New York edition, because, of course, as we know, you know, it came from Vegas, but the whole thing was, we saw everyone. So it didn't matter how old we were getting what was timely for us, the people that we admired more often than not, but also we got our parents and sometimes our grandparents' favorite entertainers as well.
Right. And I'm going to steal a little bit from Penn Jillette, because I heard him giving some thoughts on Jerry Lewis's passing earlier today. And he said, you know, we look now because we have short memories. And we look at the Beatles' arrival in New York in 1964, and we think, you know, that was huge. And he said, if you think that was huge, you should have seen it when Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis would show up together in New York City in the 50s. It was like nothing you've ever seen. Times Square would shut down for these two. They were that big. They were every mega rock star you've ever dreamed of put together in their heyday. And you look at the prescience of knowing what a career meant to both of them and putting an end to that when Jerry Lewis was, what, 26, 27?
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, it's almost like McCartney walking out on the Beatles,
right.
You know? And make no mistake about it, it wasn't Dean Martin, it was Jerry Lewis who called it a day with that act,
yep.
Which was, in his own words later on, something he regretted.
Yeah. You know,
hindsight being what it is, of course. But no matter how you look at it, Jerry Lewis was a giant. Jerry Lewis was an icon, and that's a word I'm not fond of because it is so used now, like so many other words, but Jerry Lewis truly was an icon.
Yeah.
And I'm never going to see the likes of him ever again.
So a sad goodbye to all three of them. And I mean, just what a week it was. But there's a lot else going on elsewhere. I mean, as we look around the world of pop culture, there's a couple of new artists we want to get into. Actually, a couple of artists who have been around for a little while and have given us some new stuff. But you came up with an idea about diving into an album that you and I make reference to, oh, probably as often as we refer to anything on this show. And it's no particular anniversary. There's no particular reason for it at this moment, but you're absolutely right, because we've never really taken apart why it is that we love Fables of the Reconstruction by R.E.M. as much as we do.
It just, it's always a something that comes up in conversation one way or another between us for a start.
Yep.
And, you know, it's an, to this day, I think it's still an oft and unfairly maligned record, which I always resented. I'm one of the very few people I ever knew when it came out who lauded it and loved it. You know, it was a bit more sedate. I don't like the fact that people always refer to it as always a dark album. It's not that it's dark, it may be a little constrictive and a little weirder than the other two, because, you know, R.E.M. were just so mainstream already. You know?
Yeah, right.
As I said, with my tongue very firmly planted in my cheek. But, you know, Yeah, the first listen of it, I didn't love Feeling Gravity's Pull because it was too slow. You know, when you've had three albums already, or two albums and an EP, that start off with up tempo, you already are expecting something. But then you get into a song like Maps and Legends, going right into Driver 8 and then Life and How to Live It. And I already knew Driver 8 from the year before the live shows.
Yep.
Because I was already in the set at the time of the Reckoning tour. Oh, sorry, the Little America tour, if I have to be proper and accurate. That album, when you started, now when you've absorbed the album a little bit and you've gone through the Fables of the Reconstruction side, which is side A, okay? You go through that side, and okay, I don't love Old Man Kinsey, even to this day. I'll tell you what, there are only a total of maybe two, three songs occasionally I'll skip. I always skip Old Man Kinsey and I always skip Wendell G, which is the last song on the album.
Yeah.
Okay? But then you turn the album over to the Reconstruction of the Fables side, and this is what people don't seem to realize. The actual name of the album is Fables of the Reconstruction of the Fables. Give it its full cyclical title, but it is indeed Fables of the Reconstruction, as it's properly known for the general public. So that's side A. You turn it over and it starts off with one of the weirdest things that they could have ever done. And to this day, I still think of it as a little weird. Can't Get There From Here because it's so Stax and brassy and soulful. And let's face it, those boys are whiter than I am, you know? And come on. They ain't got no soul, but yet they managed to pull that off pretty nicely. Into Green Grow the Rushes.
Yeah.
That's prime REM. But then the strangest, most ponderous song on the album is probably my third favorite REM song of all. Kahootek to me is, I think, one of their absolute criminally overlooked masterpieces. Some of the lyrics of that song are so painstakingly touching and beautiful in a very, very, you have to think about it before the emotional impact comes in. Now, why I love that album so much? It's a number of things. I loved it because it came out at a time that I was very happy. It was the album that accompanied me through my first travels into the South. It was definitely the soundtrack and companion piece, which made all the sense in the world. There's just something about that record that is very soothing to me, that it's very, you know, it's an, for me, it's a completely easily embraceable album. Like I said, you're not going to love or get it on every song from the moment you hear it for the first time, but after a spell, you know, it lives with you, and it lives with you in your musical conscience, in your lyrical conscience. It's there. And when you make a reference to it, you know I'm going to pick up on it
Yeah.
because very few people seem to make those references. You know, they'll say something really dumb and kind of silly, like, you know, I don't know, you know, this one goes out to the one I left behind. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Okay, if you're going to quote REM and you're going to put shit like that up, I'm just going to piss on you. But now, for your thoughts on that album.
Right. And see, here's why this is a good idea is because you and I come to that album from absolutely opposite positions, and we end up with some different conclusions on it too. Because my introduction to that album, and in fact my introduction to REM, because I was 13 when that album came out. And so I didn't know a lot of the history before, because when Murmur came out, I would have been about 11. So you look at what was there at the time and what I was listening to. And the first one that ever caught my ear, and I heard it on the radio because it was the first thing that REM ever got major airplay with, was Can't Get There From Here. So that was my introduction to the band. And what got me about it was the scream, the shriek that goes into every chorus, because it sounds kind of Robert Plantian. These guys, and why are they copying that from Robert Plant? So I went out and bought the record and immediately fell in love with almost every track on the album. So Driver 8, immediately hooked. Green Grow the Rushes, which you mentioned, immediately hooked because, well, I'm a big Birds fan and I love 12-string guitars, and that one, it just chimes in such a gorgeous fashion. It's outstanding. So the ones that I really grew to like over time, and you're absolutely on point about Kohoutek. The one that irritated me a little bit at the beginning, and I've grown to kind of be okay with it, is the one off the album that everybody seems to like, Auctioneer, and I could never really warm up to it that much.
No, okay, that's the other one that I kind of skip over. I don't know why. It's just it. I mean, even Good Advice is its moments. And okay, I'm gonna do something I only two people on this planet actually know slash knew, but because I'm about to make a confession. My greatest song, my triumph, even at 52, I will still refer to this as my greatest triumph. My personal favorite of any song that I've ever written, a song called Train of Thought, was actually inspired by Good Advices.
That's funny. Yeah, that's cool.
You play one up against the other, you can definitely see where the inspiration was taken from. But hey, REM stole their own songs over and over and over again. I threaded the albums together, and Everybody Hurts was rewritten on Monster for as Strange Currencies. Finest Work song turned into Turn You Inside Out between Document and Green. So it's a consistent thing, except I didn't rewrite the song. I just, oh, I like this way, the way this progresses. But what I did, I built it in a different manner. But that was the song, oddly enough. That's another reason why I feel very close to that album. I was listening to that album in particular during the summer of 87 when I, in fact, wrote Train of Thought, maybe unconsciously. And I'm not discounting it. But Driver 8 may have been an indirect influence on Train of Thought, since it's, in fact, a song about trains and home. It's not a song about a chick or anything like that.
Right, exactly. And where that album ends up with Wendell G, you said that was one of the ones that you kind of skip over. I really love that song, and I could never really put my finger on why, other than it was probably a time and place kind of thing, because a good friend of mine at the time happened to live in Lakeland, Florida, which was just down the road from where I was. And we used to get together all the time and we'd play guitars. And without fail, we would sit in his garage and pick out Wendell G and a couple of the other songs off of the album. But that one we could do a nice harmony bit with, and it just worked. So when I hear that song, I'm back in Lonnie's garage in Kathleen, Florida, you know?
See, exactly what I said earlier about time and place and memory.
Yep.
There's that, when I the day that I actually got the album was, I think, my first week or my first day at the record store when I took a job managing a local record store in the mall. So, it's that time and place thing, and I so powerful. But you know what? Me skipping over one and you loving it doesn't matter, because the bottom line is, you love a song, I love a song. It's the fact that those songs 32 years later still resonate and live with us in such a powerful way. And I always wind up falling back on that album over and over again. I think probably because when I'm thinking about things, and I mean in a deeper context, and I want to clear my mind, the way I do it is I listen to songs that have some thought to it, but they have to be songs that I really feel close to. That's why I always fall back on Kahootek.
Yeah, and I think what gets me about Wendell G. is the fact that it's a kind of a hopeless lyric, and yet there's a hopefulness in the music. Anytime you've got a banjo going, you know, there's something that's going to give you a little bit of a smile, and you know, you listen to what's going on and the melancholy that is just woven through that song, and to me, it works nicely with. It's a nice ending to that album, I think.
Right, you know, it makes me now want to go back and give that song another listen.
Yeah,
it's because now I'd be hearing it through your perspective and fresh ears.
Cool. Well, we've got plenty more to go over, and you know, if there's one thing that will get me into a good mood outside of a birdsey sounding 12-string guitar, it's what I used to refer to with my friends as blue jean rock. And I don't mean blue jean in the David Bowie context. I mean faded blue jeans on a Friday night. Again, a bunch of guys out picking guitars with smiles on their faces and just a very kind of Allman Brothers, I think, was the band that we always thought of when it came to defining blue jean rock. And now there's more, and it's brand new, and it's from a bunch of guys who are real young, and boy, do they do this well. Who are they?
Are we talking about the Trongoni Band?
We are.
Interesting that you brought up the Almonds, and the Almonds definitely are one of those that, yeah, I'm glad you used a phrase that didn't pertain to Southern rock.
Yeah, because, right, no.
Because then that automatically intimates shit kicker music, which Southern rock isn't either.
Yep.
My actual first thought was, because they're brothers in this band, not dissimilar to the Brothers Robinson.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, there's if I could pick out two bands that I hear a lot of through lines to, it's the Allman Brothers and the Black Crowes.
And the thing is, you know, I love both those bands. And of course, there's a correlation between both. But the fact is that, you know, I think that this band has a closer ring to the Black Crowes. Let's say not so much Moneymaker period, but I'd say the slower yet more melodic and more intricate things like on Southern Harmony and also on Amorica.
Yeah, the song structure is absolutely that. Yep, big time.
But yeah, these are young guys. This is their debut album. It's called Keys to the House. They're from Virginia. So, of course, since they are south of the Mason-Dixon line, they would be considered definitely blue jean and or Southern rock. But these guys really know how to they know how to hook you in, because it's not like rambling, meandering, for lack of a better phrase. You know, I don't want people to use this now as a mocking term, but you know, kind of jam band music.
Right.
So I'll use that phrase instead. You know, these are pop songs framed in that sense of what would you expect? A little boogie, a little woogie, a little soul, you know, a little bit of country twang.
Thought I found something real, and then I'll turn around. For an empty bottle and a girl from the other side of. I just left and never came back. And just left and never came back.
You know, you want that 70s sound of Fender Rhodes piano. You know, that to me is something that this band really seems to understand. So this isn't, that's the other thing. This isn't one of those almost neo-tribute styled bands. This is a band that obviously loves a certain sound and feel, and they're drawing upon that to make something that's very fresh, because it sounds great too.
Right, and it does. It puts that smile back on your face in a very I want to back up a second, because you were going down a line that I was headed down anyway, because we do this a lot, where we'll talk about these bands and we'll talk about these pieces of music they come out with, and we'll make comparisons to, I hear a little bit of Tom Petty, or I hear a little bit of the Almonds, or I hear a little bit of this band or that band. If we're trying to say that a band is copying somebody else's style, we won't pussyfoot around it. We'll come out and say, this band's copying another band's style. We've done it before. That's not what we mean, though. I mean, everybody has their influences. And I mean, you could just as easily, you know, talk about Led Zeppelin and all of that they took from Sonny Boy Williamson and B.B. King and the rest of them. But, you know, when you take something and you make it your own, if you can hear those influences in it, I see that as a very positive thing. That's not a knock on somebody.
Right. Well, the thing is, what we're talking about is we're also talking about in a sense of to give the person listening to the show
context.
Right. An idea. And the fact that if you really like the Black Crowes like we do,
yep.
or if you really like the Allman Brothers like we do, then I think you're going to like this band because it's something that you're going to appreciate, especially with the fact that these are now, quote unquote, and this is really funny to be able to say, these are classic bands because, you know, we remember when we certainly remember when the Black
Crowes
came out, right.
Yeah.
You know, those are classic bands now. And, you know, to have a young band draw from those influences, I think is terrific, as it's equally important because they've got an appreciation for a generation or two that went before them. You know, so it's not a knock. If we were going to knock something, we would actually say, here's why you should stay away from it. Here's
yep.
what's bad about it. And because you've said that, that leads me into the next topic of conversation, because this is something that went around with all of us on Popdose, but it's not part of a written article, but it is a very important, very salient topic. There apparently was recently an article written somewhere, not on Popdose, about, and it was a scathing indictment, by the way, that album reviews have become too positive.
Okay. All right.
Now, there were some very, very interesting points and counterpoints being brought up by the folks at Popdose. And I think several of us are all of the same mindset. And this is I may have said this before to you on the show, or maybe just when we were talking in general. I tend to not write negative reviews for a couple of reasons. The most important is I do not want to draw attention to lousy music.
Yeah.
If an album is bad, I don't want to give it any kind of exposure. I want it to stay where it belongs, nowhere, you know, or in limbo. If somebody else wants to appraise it and give it a thumbs up, that's fine. That's up to them. But if it's something I don't like, I am not going to give it the time of day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's going to be a very large asterisk at the end of all of this. Another reason why is I have read so many, and this is where you start to walk a very fine line, so many negative reviews of albums that it always came off as being the same thing. The writer of the critique always had to be swinging his dick around, making you feel like it was bigger than what it actually was.
Right.
I hate that. You get away from writing about the music and why you may or may not like an album. And 99 times out of 100, they always wind up becoming very personal. And that's just not right. I remember how Byron Coley used to come after REM with an absolute hatred and vengeance. And I used to think, did he fuck Pete Buck's – did Pete Buck fuck his wife or something? I mean, is that – you know, he's got the hard on for them, because
yeah.
I just never put two and two together on it. You know, there are bands that I've loved that I can criticize. Listen, I remember when I wrote the review for the complete third box set?
Yeah.
And I picked out my little nuances of why I don't like this, and I got shit for it. Did I say anything? Did I or did I not start by saying, you know, let me first say, you know, as the jumping off point, but people don't want to hear it. So at the same time, the counterpoint, and I think the most important element of this statement is brought up by Mr. Dunphy, was that you're basically, not to me, but, you know, to those who don't write these kinds of reviews, we're not being honest.
Yeah.
And you know what? He's absolutely right. We are doing a disservice. We're also doing a disservice to ourselves, you know, as writers, because if we're not going to write about the negative as well as the positive, then where is the joy? Where is the balance?
Right. And I, let me give you what I would consider to be a little bit of cover here on this, because I'm right there with you. Because I think, you know, there's a reason to harken back to an earlier time, and then there's a reason to realize that you are in the time that you are right now because of the internet. First of all, let's look at this. There are no DJs anymore. I mean, yes, there are DJs. Yes, DJs exist on the radio. There are guys who spin records and women who spin records. And they don't do the job that they did for us when we were kids, which was to be the coolest kid in the room who showed you what the next cool shit was. Those people do not exist on the radio anymore. Every single one of them is corporate owned and programmed by some guy who doesn't give a shit about the music, just wants to make the next dollar and make sure that every one of his radio stations from Boston to California sounds exactly the same. And they even voice track a lot of them, which means it's the same guy doing it in Boston as is doing it in Los Angeles. So that doesn't exist anymore. You need to depend on somebody to bring something like the Trongonies to your attention. That's your job now. And Lester Bangs was of a time. Lester Bangs was of a time when there were DJs who did do that and broke stuff in the middle of the night. And then maybe it got popular and maybe it didn't. And that, you know, you could rip something to shreds. And the thing about Lester is, love him or hate him, he had the knowledge. I mean, he had that encyclopedic knowledge of a lot of stuff that had gone before. And we live in a time now where there's 100 new digital-only albums released every day by bands, most of which you're never, ever going to hear from. So I see the job of a reviewer as being a very different thing than it was in 1974.
Well, you bring up an even greater point than went beyond that what I was thinking of, because, one, you brought up Lester Bangs. Everybody tries so hard to be the originals. Everybody wants to, you know, if you're a writer, they all think that they're going to be Lester Bangs. If you're a DJ, they think they're going to be Scott Mooney or right. Alice Steele. If they're in a band, they suddenly think that they want to be the Velvet Underground or the Stooges. Give me a fucking break. First of all, here's a novel concept. Try being yourself.
Yep.
You know, I certainly do not write to cater to a particular style. I have never thought of myself, and this is just my own personal feeling, I've never thought of myself in that vein of being like, you know, I'm the next Lester Bangs, or I'm the next, you know, David Frick or any of the other truly great writers that have written things that have lasting impressions. But the thing is that, you know, when you review something, you know, you're also taking into consideration, how will the artist feel? And I'm playing devil's advocate here, but how is the artist going to feel knowing that, you know, something that they really believed in and put a lot of time and effort and emotion and energy and money into is possibly going to be humiliated verbally? Now, the key thing is this, though, because I read through what Mr. Dunphy was saying, and this is how you can approach it with a happy medium, because I have done it in the past. It's just that writing about records I don't like just seems like a waste of time to me.
Yeah.
Writing about them, I want to get you the information on the good things. But okay, the happy medium is this. You are there to listen to and review and be objective. Why don't you like this? I don't like the harmonies. I don't like the melody. It is too derivative. The production causes the album to suffer. You can put it in reasonable, dare I say professional, academic, you know, you could put it in the right vernacular. You don't have to be an asshole about it. And nobody seems to know anymore how to walk that fine line.
Right, right. And on top of that, there is such a thing as a positive review that still points out the flaws in something. As long as you're showing where the holes are, it doesn't matter if it's positive review, negative review, recommend, don't recommend. It comes back to being honest about what you heard.
And that's something that I may have in having this you know, pop dose roundtable, albeit not published, but this conversation with everyone, it made me realize, you know what, maybe I've gotten away from doing what was really right. Because I certainly remember a couple of years ago, I reviewed the album from David Fagan's band, Snowball 37, which you and I both love. But I did, in fact, point out on several occasions that the problem with the record, because the songs are there, the playing is there, the vocals are there, the production ruined it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it made it sound like it was recorded in a bathroom. It made it sound tinny and cheap, which those songs needed to. Listen, if I was to sit down today and review anything by Husker Du, I would machine gun all of those records because they sound ghastly, and
Yep.
I mean diabolical. They are possibly the worst produced and mixed band that I can think of, because there were songs that were so big and bold and powerful that if they'd just been produced and mixed the right way, they could have exploded. Makes no sense at all. As great of a song, and of course their calling card as it is, as great of a, it can't even remotely compare with any of the songs that Bob Mould later did on the debut album by Sugar, you know, on Copper Blue, because that album was produced and mixed right.
Yeah, right. And just to show, I mean, I could rip this song to shreds. I'm not going to, but it's a horrible song. It's one of the few that I really just can't stand, and I have never liked Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA. And I could do a treatise on it and rip the thing to shreds, but to make a point about what you just said about production, that song builds to a crescendo, and the crescendo is in the final chorus where he, on the line, "I'd gladly stand up," pauses, and there's a cymbal crash. And it is about the most anemic, pissy sounding cymbal crash I've ever heard in my life. And I thought, if who produced this thing, listened back to that, heard that cymbal go, and thought, you know, we got it. That's the job of a producer, and he fucked it up. And I thought, if I needed one more reason to hate that song, there it is.
Well, this is, again, and I know I probably overemphasize the point too often, but this is why I appreciate and enjoy being part of the Popdose family as much as I do, because it made me stop and think, you know what? Maybe I have to, you know, walk back what I'm thinking when I'm writing these reviews. Now, a lot of these records that I've gotten lately, they're in a certain vein, so I like the way they come off and they feel. So I've got nothing to complain about, you know?
Right. Well, let's get into another record then, because we do have another one to talk about. And for people who don't know the history, again, this goes back right to my latter high school days and your college days when Peter Himmelman first came on the scene. Where was he at the time?
Well, for me, the first time I ever heard of him and was intrigued was he put out an album called Gematria in 1987. 87 was a good year for music, I have to say. Except for that REM album that I don't want to mention. that was their final nail in my coffin for them. Yeah. So there you go. There's a criticism. And in fact, when I reviewed the box set for Document, I said exactly why I don't like that record.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a dickish way. Not, you know, look at me. I can thump my chest because I have the power of the computer. I said what I said because I still don't like that album, and I never will. Anyway, getting back to Mr. Himmelman.
Yes.
You know, I thought he was a very interesting guy. At the time, you know, I'd read that he was, in fact, engaged to a woman named Maria Dillon, who happened to be the daughter of this guy from Minnesota.
Bobby Zimmerman?
That's it, Zim. You can call him Bobby, or you can call him RJ, or you can call him whatever the fuck it is, because you'd have to serve somebody. Yeah, he was going to marry Maria Dillon, and sure enough, he did. So now, 30 years later, and they've got these kids, and Peter Himmelman is still writing incredible, what I would consider some of the most literary lyrics there are.
Yeah.
His songs read, and they read very well. And you can take them as written words, not just part of songs. But this new album is called There Is No Calamity, which is obviously very tongue-in-cheek. This is what I really like about this album, is that it's very subtle.
She flew away from expectations, the smoke, the shuddering waves. She longed for something primitive, something no mortal ever craved. A feather to her nostril, she watched it flutter with a breath. She fought off a desire to laugh, she fought off a desire for death. I pity you, you who have it all figured out. I pity you, who never raise a finger, who never dare to shout. No calamity, no reason to rejoice. I pity you, my poor spirit, could not make one of the choice.
This is an album that is burning anger, but in a not loud, not thumping the drums, not, you know, pounding the pulpit, none of that. It's just very, you have to listen to the words and you have to pay attention to get what he says. Case in point, a song that just by the title alone, Rich Men Rule the World.
Right. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. So that's where this one jumps off from. And you put it perfectly when you talked about it being a very literary kind of songwriting. And this one in particular, the name of the album is derived from a line in the song that you linked on the page with your review. And it struck me, like a lot of the songwriters that I really admire for being able to weave a melancholy through a song, like, you know, again, making a comparison that's not a musical comparison at all, but almost like Mark Cohn has a tendency to do with his stuff.
But Mark Cohn's got walking issues. Walking in Memphis, walk out to Winter. I mean, he's got issues.
True enough. But with Cohn, he's got that line of melancholy. And you're right. I mean, in this one, it's not a line of melancholy, although it sounds like one if you listen only to what's going on with the piano and with some of the other instrumentation in the songs. But it also has that undercurrent of just white hot rage, and I love it. I mean, it's such an interesting thing, an interesting dichotomy to listen to.
It's rational lyrical rage,
yep,
is what it is.
Right.
You know, I mean, just the words alone. Rich men run the world here. It don't run on mercy. It runs on fear.
Yeah,
I think that speaks many, many volumes. But then you get something like "Love Is What Carries Us Away." It's one of those not standard arrangements with different movements. It's very Brian Wilson-esque, you know, post-Smile, let's say around Friends.
Right.
The Friends, you know, because Wild Honey is definitely not Brian's album. You know, he's not really too into that, you know. And then you get something like, you know, Ropes and Wings, which he just pinched right from the Stax book, you know. It's got Hammond B3 and, you know, a nice horn section, and it's kind of got that gospel vibe to it. So it's not like it's going to be some kind of immediately pigeonholed album of some balladeer or some, you know, son-in-law of Dylan with his angry manifestos. You know, Peter Himmelman is not that kind of writer. He's a very thoughtful, he's got his own personality, and you have to understand that from the get-go. You know, he's not just a singer and songwriter, he's a writer. You know, he's a very, very rounded individual, so he can't be pigeonholed. He just happened to put out a new album finally,
yeah,
which is his first album in I think 3 years. So the bottom line is, while he's grown, because he's grown older simply and you know, seen a lot more from the days of when he put out an album, again literary but in a different way, like Gematria, you know, 30 years ago to now, you could see it's the same artist, and you're watching his growth and maturity,
yeah,
in leaps and bounds.
That's a cool thing. And again, the new one is called There Is No Calamity. Definitely a must get. And it is the kind of album that, even though that rage is there and it's apparent when you really take a good look at it, if you want an album that you can listen to without feeling browbeaten about it, you can do that with this one too. You can listen passively to this one and you won't lose much. So definitely want to check this one out. There's one thing before we get to the In Our Head segment. There has been some movement on the political front this week, and it remains just an absolute monstrosity, what's going on in the White House. But the reaction to it on Capitol Hill has been the same sort of impotent rage where they say, oh, we can't believe he said that. We still support him, but we can't believe he said that. And it's just so completely pointless. But the one thing that made headlines was just a couple of days ago when Steve Bannon, the chief strategist for Donald Trump, was summarily dismissed from the White House. And afterward, he wiped off his chin long enough to say that this is the end of the Trump presidency. Just, if only. I mean, from his lips.
Going to war?
Yeah, that was from the Breitbart Twitter feed. They just wrote the word war as soon as the announcement was made.
And a very dear friend of mine, one of the most thoughtful, finest musicians you'll ever meet, a gentleman named Jimmy Lee, said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he put it perfectly, because there's so many people were coming in their pants when they heard that Bannon was out on Friday, and I thought, okay, you know what? You people are being really, really predictably childish about this.
Yep.
You know, your jubilation is appreciated, but it is premature because, A, he's still out there, and what he does away from the limelight of being part of the Trump government could be possibly more dangerous.
Right.
It's kind of like the whole hoopla over, oh, GoDaddy got rid of the Daily Stormer. Well, now it's on the dark web, so now you can't monitor it.
Yeah.
You know, this is how dumb the left is, how incredibly ass backwards they do everything. They would rather clap their hands and stomp their feet, you know, like, oh, look, he's gone now. Right. He's gone now, but look who else may still be in there. I mean, look at somebody like Stephen Miller. Who
right.
is just, he's just as disgusting.
And Sebastian, just, whatever that asshole's name is. Yeah, he's good.
How come he can't be deported?
Exactly.
Send back to the planet, asshole, you know?
Well, there's a couple of things about Steve Bannon's dismissal. First of all, you mentioned the left being completely juvenile about this. And of course, it's absolutely true. But the problem with doing that and the problem with, you know, doing the, yay, you know, going out in the streets and clapping hands is that they missed everything that led up to it. First of all, this bullshit about, whoa, I thought it was an off-the-record conversation with this left-wing magazine he gave an interview to. First of all, why is Steve Bannon giving an interview to a left-wing magazine for the first time ever? Second of all, he thought it was off the record. My ass, he thought it was off the record. Third of all, what did he say in that interview that got him fired? First of all, he torpedoed Trump by saying, oh, we can't go to war with North Korea. It's all a bunch of horse shit. And then followed that right up with, oh, those guys who were out there on the alt-right, you know, protesting, calling themselves neo-Nazis in Charlottesville, they're a bunch of boneheads. Well, he called them clowns, I think. So what does that do? Well, it gives Trump reason to fire him that makes sense on both sides. So now the left can say, well, he only fired him because he torpedoed his Korea policy, so he had to fire him. And that also placates the sensible right. It's the sensible Republicans can say, well, yeah, of course. I mean, you can't torpedo his Korea policy and stay as his chief strategist. But then he follows that right up with calling the neo-Nazi guys clowns. What does that do? It gives him credibility among, again, the Klan and David Duke and his crowd, because now Steve Bannon, who just called them all clowns, was fired by who again? Donald Trump, the guy that they have professed nothing but support from since Charlottesville.
Donald Trump, who can't tell the difference on the words heel and heel. I don't remember the last time it was probably at the very beginning of this year the last time I tweeted, but I finally had to tweet. And I simply said, the president of the United States does not comprehend the English language.
Yep.
Sad. And that's it. Because he proved yesterday for the umpteenth time he's a fucking remedial, which translated into the simple English is Donald Trump is a fucking retard.
Yeah.
Okay? We're not going to pretty this one up. And listening to him or reading him, because every time he opens his mouth, he just regurgitates more stupidity. I said it to you last time. I'll say it again. We're going to hear him say more random shit as we go along, and it's going to be the complete non sequiturs.
Right.
You know, bigly.
You'll see in a couple of days. You'll see in a week. Oh, you'll see. It'll be big things.
Oh, North Korea. I kills them all one by one. You know? I'm telling you, it's coming.
Right.
By the way, you know, where is the hand wringing and unity and the popping up on certainly on Facebook of the Spanish flag since Barcelona happened? How come everybody, you know, collectively came together, came
Paris.
On each other, whatever,
right.
all the shit with Paris, but people are killed in Barcelona?
Yeah.
You know,
13, 14 people now, yeah.
Yeah, where's the I stand with Barcelona, je suis, you know, España, whatever the fuck. I don't know, I don't speak Spanish. The point is, where the fuck is everybody? Is it not convenient? Well, you know, it just goes to show you that the left really do have their collective head up their collective ass.
Yeah, really. And I mean, on Fawlty Towers, this is where Manuel came from. I mean, if you can't get sentimental about Barcelona, I don't know who you are. Now, that brings us to our In Our Head segment for this week, where we always like to wind up with just some random thoughts about a piece of music or a musical genre. And we're doing this segment of the show just hours before the sun will be blotted out from the sky. And then with any luck, it'll come back again. And by the way, if you missed Dave Barry's Miami Herald column on the eclipse, go back and read it. It's a fucking riot. But with the eclipse now just hours away, I figured we could talk about whatever the perfect song would be. And I mean, there are some obvious choices. I know Bonnie Tyler is going to be on a cruise somewhere.
Say that fucking song. I'm just through the computer.
The only reason I'm mentioning it is because she's going to be on a cruise ship somewhere that will be sailing along the eclipse path, and she's going to perform that awful song while it's going on. And while Pink Floyd's Eclipse certainly stands out as a monstrous possibility here, there are so many great songs about the moon, so many great songs about darkness, so many great songs about seeing the sun blotted out from the sky, thank you, Rolling Stones, that I hand it over to you and ask you for some of your thoughts on some things people could put together for a playlist for the eclipse.
Invisible Sun by The Police.
Yeah. How well, it may be a little on the nose, but how about Moonshadow by Cat Stevens?
Or how about Moondance by Van Morrison?
There you go. Absolutely.
Or Moonshine Man by Herman's Hermits.
Yeah.
Or, of course, one of the greatest songs of all time, The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore by the Walker Brothers.
Here's a place you're in with nothing to lose but no more.
That there are so many songs that use, because darkness is such a wonderful word, and I mean certainly at Bruce Springsteen's
Police called Darkness, which is also on Ghost in the Machine, where Invisible Sun is.
That's
also.
Right.
So you know, that's a Stuart Copeland song,
right. And of course Bruce Springsteen's Darkness on the Edge of Town, not only a song title but an album title as well. So you could go in a number of different directions with the darkness thing, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's time for a playlist.
You know, there we go.
Which one?
Night Moves by Bob Seger.
Night Moves. You've got 2 minutes. Get it over with quick, kids. it'll be exactly like that first time in the back of a 60 Chevy for most of us. 2 minutes is about right.
Nighttime is the Right Time by the Strangelovs.
Yeah. Oh, all the soul classics about nighttime. Oh, man.
Let's see. Well, come on. Start spewing them out. I can't be the brains behind this album. The Jerry Lewis here.
Yeah, that's right. But I still think Painted Black would be a great one.
Or Undercover of the Night.
There you go. Rolling Stones, back to the Stones once again. Sure.
Yeah. This is fun because I'm looking at Big Star. Are there any fucking songs about nighttime?
Nighttime, well, right.
Star third, duh. Shit. Fucking stabbed me right in the face. I apologize profusely to Jody and of course, to the memory of Alex. Holy shit.
Right. But the one thing to keep in mind, of course, is don't look directly at it. And there is no dark side of the moon, really. Matter of fact, it's all dark.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, and the moon is made of green cheese.
Well, that sets us up very well for our next conversation. I know we've got a ton that's going on the website this week on popdose.com, and you're encouraged, of course, every week here to look around at what else is happening in the books column, in the TV column, and elsewhere in the music columns as well. Just kick around, have a good time, and enjoy yourself. And Rob Ross, I'll talk to you again in a week.
Yes, indeed, sir. Hopefully I'll be recovered from this cold and recovered from the... I'm going to just give one last rant. to the disgraceful middle of the night trades that the New York Mets made after the trade deadline. The Mets gutted the team.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're following this story, but nobody else has been doing this. They gutted all their major players who actually were productive. You know, right after you and I got together the last time, they shipped off, you know, and I'd ranted about them just getting rid of Lucas Duda and Addison Reed during the trade deadline period. They shipped off Jay Bruce to the Indians, Neil Walker to the Brewers, and now most heinously, on Friday night after the game, they shipped off Curtis Granderson, who was one of the best. And he's a real throwback to what everything that is good about baseball. One of the best team and fans guys you'd ever want to have on your team. They shipped him out to the Dodgers. And yesterday they lost their catcher, Rene Rivera, to waivers to the Cubs. So the Mets have systematically destroyed the team that was built to have a 3 or 4 year run for the playoffs, if not the actual World Series. You know, anchored by a starting rotation that have all been on the disabled list this year. Way to go, guys. You made this a wasted, lost summer.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but, you know, we were here in St. Louis watching the Cardinals make a run at it, and who knows? I mean, they may still get there. I'd have to check the standings again. But given the chance to really put it away, what did they do? They foundered. Again. So there weren't any real big moves to speak of as far as the Cardinals are concerned, except for if you count down the standings.
Well, there you go. So we have the NHL season to look forward to. By the way, somebody posted Kaepernick should go to the Jets. That's hate speech. You know where Kaepernick should go besides to hell? To the Patriots. That's where he belongs.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah.
Where do all dicks belong in football?
Yeah, it used to be the Raiders. Now it's New England.
Yep.
All right. Well, Rob, I'm glad you got it off your chest, my man. Thank you, and I hope it turns out better for you next season.
All right, I'll talk to you next week.
See you then.